The scripture reading this evening before mixed lesson will be taken from the book of Ruth, the first chapter. We'll be reading verses 1 through verse 5, if you'd like to follow. Ruth, the first chapter, verses 1 through 5. And it reads, "And it came to pass in the days when the judges judged, and there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem, Judah, went to sojourn in the country of Moab, he and his wife and his two sons. And the name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife was Naomi. And the name of the two sons was Mahlon and Chilion, Ephraimites of Bethlehem, Judah. And they came into the country of Moab and continued there. And Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left, and her two sons. And they took them wives of the women of Moab. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other Ruth. And they dwelt there about 10 years. And Mahlon and Chilion died, both of them. And the woman was left of her two children and of her husband."
I know that some of the younger ones are studying from the period of the judges and the early prophets and studying from the book of Ruth. The book of Ruth is an exciting book about a particular woman, but the setting, the background against which we read in the book of Ruth is also very interesting. You'll notice in the first verse it tells us when the judges judged, there was a famine in the land. The period of the time at the end of the judges, as you'll notice in verse 25, tells us that essentially every man was doing what he wanted to, that is, what was right in his own eyes. The sons of Israel did that which was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they frequently forgot God. It was an evil, a very violent period. The book of Ruth, set during this particular time, we see how that God uses people and how that He works to accomplish His purposes even during such difficult times. It's during this time that existed among the people of God of spiritual distress and even physical deprivation that we read about Naomi's husband taking the family away from Bethlehem and Judah to become refugees in the land of Moab. Now, there were all kinds of reasons not to go to Moab. The history of the beginning of the Moabites would certainly be one reason. As you turn back into the book of Genesis, chapter 19, and in verses 30 through verse 38, the daughters of Lot determined that there was not going to be a lineage. And so both of them got Lot drunk and lay with Lot and had children from their father. This was the beginning of the Moabites and the Ammonites. And as we read further in Numbers chapters 22 through chapter 24, another very familiar story to most of you, it was Balak, who was the king of Moab, who hired Balaam to curse the people of God. And in every effort that Balaam exerted to cause the people of God to be cursed, it turned into a blessing. And then, of course, Balaam instructed Balak, the king of Moab, how to get the people to intermarry with the heathen nations and cause the curses, essentially, of God to come upon them. And, of course, we read about that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, how that thousands of them died because of the fornication that they committed with these heathen women. And then another reason not to move to Moab was the recent oppression by Eglon, the king of Moab. In Judges chapter 3, beginning in verse 15, you can read about that. And you'll note there that Eglon, the king of Moab, is described as a very fat man. And the judge Ehud took a sword and thrust him through. And ultimately, Eglon died, and the people of God were delivered. But the Moabites had a history with the Israelites. And there was another reason why one would not want to go to Moab. And that had to do with the Moabite culture and the god Chemosh. You'll note, if you will read back in 2 Kings chapter 3, in verse 27 specifically, that during difficult times, the Moabites would offer their children as an offering unto Chemosh. Now, all of these reasons put together would make Moab a place that would not be a place you would want to visit, much less to live there for 10 years. But if you'll notice in verse 1, it tells us that there was a famine in the land, that is, in the land of Canaan. There was a famine, and so there was not enough food to eat. But there was rain in Moab. Now, what would you do? To provide for the necessities of your family, you might consider moving to a place like Moab, as the man Elimelech decided to do. And so he took his family, and he went to the land of Moab. Now, if you'll look on the chart that we have before us, a map, you'll see that Bethlehem is located right there, and the land of Moab, it depends upon which source you read after. They tell us it was some 30, perhaps 60 miles, some say 40 to 60 miles, depending on the course that you traveled to get to Moab. So, Elimelech didn't move very far, but he moved to a place that was hostile to the people of God. Now, Ruth is described in this context as a very faithful woman, a follower of God. Now, when you cast that against the gods of the Moabites, you'll find that Ruth bore some distinctiveness in that quality. The men died. Elimelech died. The boys died. And the two daughters-in-law and Naomi were left. And Naomi gives instructions to the daughters-in-law that you need to remain in Moab with your people. In verse 8, Naomi said unto her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. Jehovah deal kindly with you as ye have dealt with the dead and with me. Jehovah grant you that ye may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voice and wept. Now, Ruth did not want to return home. In verse 16, the text tells us that she said unto Naomi, "Entreat me not to leave thee, and to return from following after thee. For whether thou goest, I will go. And where thou lodgest, I will lodge. Thy people shall be my people, and thy God my God. Where thou diest, will I die, and there will I be buried. Jehovah do so to me and more also, if aught but death part thee and me." Now sometimes we read those verses when two people are getting married, as we illustrate the kind of commitment that is made in the marriage relationship. But that's not really the point being made here. The point being made here is a commitment indicating Ruth's relationship to Naomi, but not to Naomi alone, but also her relationship to the people of God and to the God of Israel. You'll notice she said, "Thy people shall be my people, and thy God, my God." Rather than to continue to worship Chemosh, we find that Ruth had been converted to the Lord. Through Naomi and her family, she had learned some things about one God. "Thy God shall be my God." Ruth was a faithful follower of God. But we also notice in these verses that she was loyal to Naomi. Ruth indeed had the opportunity to return. But if she had returned, there would have obviously been some problems. But when we consider the level of Ruth's commitment, not only do we read about that in the first chapter, actually continuing down through verse 18, but if you'll turn over to the fourth chapter of the book of Ruth and look in verse 15, it was said of Ruth, "For thy daughter-in-law who loveth thee who is better to thee than seven sons. Ruth's commitment and loyalty to Naomi was something that was recognized by a lot of people. Her value to Naomi, she's better than seven sons. That speaks worthily of her. But there are some other things we want to notice about loyalty. Loyalty in and of itself is important. We need to be loyal to God, loyal to His Word. Before the period of the judges, when we read of Joshua leading the people into the promised land, in Joshua chapter 24 in verse 15, the familiar text, Joshua calls upon them to choose you this day whom ye will serve, whether the gods which your fathers served that were beyond the river, or the gods of the Amorites in whose land ye dwell, but as for me and my house, we will serve Jehovah. Joshua expresses loyalty to God, and he calls upon the people to express the same loyalty, the same commitment. And they do so in verse 16. They said, far be it from us that we should forsake Jehovah to serve other gods. Joshua tells them, if you forsake Jehovah in verse 20 and serve foreign gods, then he will turn and do you evil and consume you after that he hath done you good. And again, the people affirm their loyalty to God. Loyalty is important. But by the beginning of the period of the judges, after Joshua dies, in chapter 2 and verse 10, we learn that the people arose, another generation arose, that knew not Jehovah, nor yet the work which he had wrought for Israel. What happened to the loyalty? The loyalty is gone. Even during the period of wilderness wandering, as they were brought up out of the land of Egypt, you'll note that they had seen the great plagues that God had brought upon the Egyptians. They had seen the waters of the Red Sea part and walked across on dry ground. They had seen how that God had fed them with manna and how that He brought forth water from a rock. But then they continued to murmur and complain, murmur and complain. Their loyalty to God certainly was to be questioned. Loyalty to God is important. In Deuteronomy chapter 6 and in verse 4, loyalty to God was something that was to be taught unto their children. In Deuteronomy chapter 6, beginning in verse 4, the writer says, hear, O Jehovah, or hear, O Israel, Jehovah our God is one Jehovah. And thou shalt love Jehovah thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy might. And these words which I command thee this day shall be upon thy heart. And you're familiar with this text. How that they were to teach their children when they got up, when they went to bed, when they went out, when they came home. And there was a reason for that. In verse 10 it says, and it shall be when Jehovah thy God shall bring thee into the land which he sware unto thy fathers, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to give thee, great and goodly cities which thou buildest not, and houses full of all good things which thou fillest not, and cisterns hewn out, which thou hewedest not, vineyards and olive trees, which thou plantest not, and thou shalt eat and be full, then beware lest thou forget Jehovah, who brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage. Loyalty to God was something that was to be held sacred. They were to be faithful to God. But yet we find they were not faithful to God. Loyalty was something that was to be questioned. Let me ask you, beloved, when we talk about loyalty, loyalty to our spouses is important. In Genesis chapter 2 and in verse 24, when the marriage relationship was first instituted, God said that man is to leave father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall be one flesh. The idea of leaving and cleaving is something that we've hammered home and hammered home time after time. Leave father and mother and cleave to. Bruce, we use the illustration of being welded to. How that two pieces of metal simply are blended together so that they become one. And you can't take them apart without doing damage to both. And so loyalty to our spouses is something that was emphasized by the Lord when the Pharisees in Matthew chapter 19 asked the question, is it lawful for a man to put away his wife for every cause? And Jesus said, have ye not read? And he referred them back to the beginning, to Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Now, friend, loyalty to our spouses is something that God required from the beginning. Loyalty to our children is something that is so many times overlooked. In Ephesians chapter 6 and verse 4, fathers are to bring up, as we quote the King James translation, our children in the nurture and admonition of the Lord. We've talked about Exodus chapter 12 with regard to the institution of the Passover feast, so that as their children would grow and observe this Passover feast and ask, what meaneth this feast? It would be a duty and an obligation, as well as a privilege and an opportunity, for those parents to tell their children of the great things that God did in bringing them forth up out of the land of Egypt. And then in Joshua chapter 4, as they crossed over into the promised land, crossing the Jordan River and setting up the pillar of stones in Gilgal, and how that when they would travel that way and their children would ask, what meaneth these stones, Carolyn, as you referred to the little pile of rocks on the table? Children are curious, aren't they? They ask questions. What meaneth these stones? That you can use this as a privilege, an opportunity, an occasion to teach them how that God brought them into the promised land. Loyalty would demand that, would it not? To our children. Loyalty to our parents. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. Very simply put, for this is right. End of story. Obey your parents. Loyalty. This is what God requires. But that's not all that's said about a child's relationship to their parents. In 1 Timothy chapter 5, reading beginning in verse 4, Paul writes, but if any widow hath children or grandchildren, let them learn first to show piety toward their own family and to requite their parents, that is, to repay their parents, for this is acceptable in the sight of God. And then in verse 8 the writer says, but if any provideth not for his own, and especially his own household, he hath denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. One's household may very well include his parents. To requite, to repay, to care for his parents. Loyalty is very important. The Apostle Paul, as we have been studying in our Sunday morning class, demands loyalty toward our brethren. In Romans chapter 12, reading beginning at verse 9, Paul said, Let love be without hypocrisy. Abhor that which is evil, cleave to that which is good. In love of the brethren, be tenderly affectioned one to another, in honor, preferring one another. And he elaborates on that. Our relationship to our brethren. Those Hebrews, as we've discussed so many times, who were suffering persecution by those who would demand that they return to the practices of the law. In Hebrews chapter 13, in verse 5, the writer says, be free from the love of money, content with such things as ye have, for himself hath said, I will in no wise fail thee, neither will I in any wise forsake thee. Well, certainly they are assured of the presence of God, but what comfort it is to be assured of the presence of their brethren. They've done that in Hebrews chapter 10. Turn back, if you will, to verse 32. He says, but call to remembrance the former days, in which after ye were enlightened, ye endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly being made a gazing stock, both by reproaches and afflictions, and partly becoming partakers with them that were so used. For ye both had compassion on them that were in bonds, and took joyfully the spoiling of your possessions, knowing that ye have for yourselves a better possession and an abiding one. Cast not away, therefore, your boldness, which hath great recompense of reward. He says, you've done this. You've been loyal and faithful to your brethren to support them during this time of persecution. He says, becoming partakers with them that were so used. Loyalty is important, brethren. Ruth was loyal to Naomi. Ruth also was a very hard worker. I tried to depict in this picture what it is to glean in the fields, to harvest grain, to go by hand and to pick up the grain, harvested or cut off with, I forgot what they call those things. a sickle, thank you, just drew blank, a sickle. And they would cut it off and go by and pick it up and put it into stocks, shocks. Tell me again.
A sickle.
They would cut it off and bind it up. And Naomi and Ruth would glean in the fields. Turn, if you will, to chapter 2 of the book of Ruth. In chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, Naomi had a kinsman of her husband's, a mighty man of wealth, of the family of Elimelech. And his name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Let me now go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after him in whose sight I shall find favor." And she said unto her, "Go, my daughter." Now, I want you to notice as we drop down in the text just a little bit into verse 6. It says, "And the servant that was set over the reapers answered and said, It is the Moabitish damsel that came back with Naomi out of the country of Moab. And she said, Let me glean, I pray you, and gather after the reapers among the sheaves. So she came and hath continued even from the morning until now, save that she tarried a little in the house." Ruth gleaned in the fields. She gleaned for a long time. Look, if you will, beginning at verse 14. It says, "And at mealtime Boaz said unto her, Come hither and eat of the bread, and dip thy morsel in the vinegar. And she sat beside the reapers, and they reached her parched grain. And she did eat, and was sufficed, and left thereof. And when she was risen up to glean," look at that carefully. Here is a woman that's working in the field. It's mealtime. She sits down to eat. After she's through eating, unlike many of us who might like to take a nap, she gets up and goes back to work. Look further in the text. "Boaz commanded his young men, saying, Let her glean even among the sheaves, and reproach her not. And also pull out some for her from the bundles, and leave it, and let her glean, and rebuke her not." In verse 17, "So she gleaned in the field unto even." The point being, here is a woman that was willing to work all day long in the fields, gleaning, going along behind those who had harvested and picking up what's left. Boaz said to those who were the reapers, "You leave some for her." And when she begins to glean and she reaches into, or when you reach into the bundles, you pull some out and leave it for her. Well, she found favor with Boaz, but she was willing to work. Look further in the text. In verse 23, it says, "So she kept fast by the maidens of Boaz to glean unto the end of barley harvest and of wheat harvest, and she dwelt with her mother-in-law." Now somebody say, "Well, how long did it take to harvest?" Well, if you turn back to Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 9, it took 7 weeks to harvest. That's a long time to work from morning till night to glean the wheat and the barley. But that's what Ruth did. Now, we might raise the question, why did she do that? Well, remember that Naomi and Ruth have traveled, or rather Naomi and her family, have traveled down to Moab because there was a famine in Canaan. Their husbands have died. And now they've come back, and they have nothing. We're going to learn in just a little bit that Naomi had a field, and she sold it. Why would she sell it? So that she could live. Now, friend, when they came back, they had nothing. They had to glean in the fields to have the necessities of life. Hard work is important. Sometimes we think that it's a terrible thing to have to work hard. But hard work is important. In Ephesians chapter 4 and in verse 28, the writer says, "Let him that stole steal no more. But rather let him labor, working with his hands the thing that is good, that he may have whereof to give to him that hath need." Paul said, you work, so you'll have the necessities of life, but moreover, you'll be able to help others. We mentioned this morning that there was error being taught in the church in Thessalonica, that you don't have to work. You see, the second coming of the Lord is imminent, and there were those who had
refused to work. And Paul said, if a man won't work, neither let him eat. You see, provisions existed in ancient times so that those who harvested would leave grain so that those who wanted to eat could glean from the fields and have the things necessary to life. But they had to work in order to get it. You see, there really wasn't a free handout in ancient times. Ruth was willing to work. She had learned a very hard lesson. You'll also notice in the Ephesian letter, in the 6th chapter, a very important principle that when we work, we are to give a day's work for a day's pay. In Ephesians chapter 6, the principle is taught regarding the relationship of servants and masters. Look, if you will, in Ephesians chapter 6, beginning at verse 5, it says, "Servants, be obedient unto them that, according to the flesh, are your masters, with fear and trembling and singleness of your heart as unto Christ, not in the way of eye service as men pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will, doing service as unto the Lord and not unto men. Knowing that whatsoever good thing each one doeth, the same shall he receive again from the Lord, whether he be bond or free." Paul is saying, don't just work when somebody's watching, but you work as unto the Lord. Ruth had learned that. She had learned this principle of work. And friend, we need to learn that. There are many in our society that need to learn the principle of work. The wisdom writer in Ecclesiastes chapter 9 and in verse 10 said, "Whatsoever thy hand findeth to do, do it with thy might. For there is no work, nor device, nor knowledge, nor wisdom in Sheol whether thou goest." When you work hard. And that's what Ruth did. Now there is a passage that when I was growing up was somewhat obscure to me. I don't know if my dad knew that this was in the Bible, but he certainly understood it. In Lamentation chapter 3 and verse 27, the text tells us it is good for a man that he bear the yoke in his youth. As most of you know, I grew up on a farm. And there was always something to do. If you couldn't do anything else, you could always go out in the field and pick up rocks. A rocky field is a hard place to grow a crop. So Dad would have us go out and pick up rocks. If there wasn't anything else, you could always pick up rocks. In fact, my dad, when he was older, said that the only way to get rid of rocks was simply to die and leave them. You can always do something. Even when you're very young, there's work to be done. As you can learn this valid principle, hard work is important. Ruth had learned that. But something else is very important about Ruth. Ruth had a good reputation. We've learned that she was faithful to God. She had made her commitment to God. She was very loyal and faithful to her mother-in-law, even to the extent of providing for her. She was a very hard worker. And that would bring us to the conclusion that she had a good reputation. In chapter 2, in verse 11, we see that she had left Moab. She had left her family. She had left the religion of the Moabites. She had left it all in order to be with her mother-in-law and go back to Naomi's homeland. In verse 11, "And Naomi said, Turn again, my daughters, why will you go with me? Yet have I sons in my womb that they may be your husbands." Or your husband? No. No, that was not it. I'm in chapter 1. Let me look at chapter 2, the passage I have on the board. It says, "And Boab answered and said unto her, It hath fully been showed me all that thou hast done unto thy mother-in-law since the death of thy husband, and how thou hast left thy father and thy mother and the land of thy nativity, and art come unto a people that thou knewest not heretofore." That's a great sacrifice, isn't it, on Ruth's part? She left everything to even be associated with people that she didn't know. Left it all. Well, another introduction to Naomi's character is in the 3rd chapter in verse 11. It says, "And now, my daughter, fear not. I will do to thee all that thou sayest, for all the city of my people doth know that thou art a worthy woman. You see, Ruth had a good reputation. Everybody knew of her character. They knew that she was a worthy woman. It's not our purpose, nor do we have the time tonight, to discuss the qualities of a worthy woman. It's in your lesson sheet. You can read it from Proverbs chapter 31. But we learn here that Ruth was indeed noted throughout the city, or throughout the land, as a worthy woman. Friend, a good reputation is important, isn't it? It's important what people think about you. I've heard people say, I'm going to do such and such and I don't care what anybody thinks. You ever heard people say that? Maybe you've been guilty of saying that. You better care what other people think, because you see, your influence is important. Your reputation is on the line. In Proverbs chapter 22 and in verse 1, the wisdom writer said, a good name is rather to be chosen than great riches, and loving favor rather than silver and gold. Your reputation is worth more than all the money in the world. What people think about you is important. In Ecclesiastes chapter 7 and in verse 1, the wisdom writer said, a good name is better than precious oil, and the day of death than the day of one's birth. What people say about you and believe about you, you better consider that as important. Ruth did. She had a good reputation. She was known for the good that she did. Your influence is important. In Matthew chapter 5 and verses 13 through verse 16, we are referred to as the light of the world, a city set on a hill that cannot be hid. We are referred to as salt of the earth. And if it has lost its savor, it is worth nothing but to be cast underfoot. Now the reason that we are the light of the world and the salt of the earth is described in verse 16, even so let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven. You see, your reputation says something about who you are. And if you claim to be a disciple of the Lord, and you live an ungodly, immoral, disobedient life, you're not bringing glory to God. You're bringing shame and dishonor to Him. The apostle writing to those in Philippi said in Philippians chapter 2, beginning at verse 12, so then, my brethren, even as ye have always obeyed, not as in my presence only, but now much more in my absence, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who worketh in you both to will and to work for His good pleasure. Do all things without murmurings and questionings, that ye may become blameless and harmless children of God without blemish in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom ye are seen as lights in the world, holding forth the word of life, that I may have whereof to glory in the day of Christ, that I do not run in vain, neither labor in vain. You see, how you live reflects not only what you believe about God, but it can also influence the thinking of others about God. Ruth considered that very important. But I want you to notice just briefly some rewards of Ruth's character. Boaz cared for Ruth. He was a kinsman and he favored her. Now the fact that he was a kinsman brought responsibility. We'll talk about that in just a moment. In chapter 8 of verse 2, we saw how that he instructed her to glean in my fields. Don't glean anywhere else. And we also note in verse 15 how that he instructed those who were laboring in his fields, you leave grain for Ruth. You pull it out of the sheaves and leave it for her. And in chapter 3 and in verse 17, he gave her 6 measures of grain. He favored her. But we also notice that she requested redemption from Boaz. In the 3rd chapter, this is quite fascinating to me, as we think about the relationship and the responsibilities of a kinsman. A kinsman. A kinsman had the responsibility of caring for one whom one of his family members had died and married, perhaps had responsibilities to, and now because of the death could not carry out those responsibilities. The kinsman had those responsibilities to purchase what had been sold that was a part of the inheritance. Now you remember that Naomi had come out of the country of Moab and had sold a parcel of land. Well, somebody had the opportunity, a kinsman, to buy that back. so that it could continue as the family inheritance, to purchase the land and to preserve the inheritance in the family according to the custom of Israel. We also notice in Ruth chapter 4 and in verse 4, it says, "And I thought to disclose it unto thee." Here is a nearer kinsman. And Boaz says that there's somebody else that has a greater responsibility than I do because he's nearer kinfolk than I am. And so he went and talked to him about the responsibility of a kinsman. Now that's interesting to me, because as he begins to explain what that means, he said to him in verse 4, "And I thought to disclose it unto thee, saying, buy it before them that sit here, and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know. For there is none to redeem it besides thee, and I am after thee." Then said Boaz, "What day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, and raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance." And the near kinsman said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Take thou my right of redemption on thee, for I cannot redeem it." Now that all is so interesting to me, because as Boaz says to this other nearer kinsman, here's what that means if you redeem this inheritance. You not only rebuy the land, but you get Naomi, and you get Ruth, and it's your responsibility to raise up children to her dead husband. Now that's a pretty big responsibility. Now this other near kinsman, he reflects on that and he said, "Well, I can't do that." He said, "I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance." What does that mean? He has a wife. He has children. Now, what's his wife and children going to think if he takes another wife and bears children? He said, "I'll mar my inheritance. I can't do that." So Boaz said, "Well, I'll take care of that." Now, that's a very loose paraphrase. But Boaz is going to take care of Ruth. Now, I want to call your attention back to verse 2 of chapter 4. In verse 2, it says that Boaz took 10 men of the elders of the city and said, "Sit ye down here." And they sat down. Now the point of that is, there is a deal that's about to take place. And according to the custom of these people, when a deal would take place, and I use that expression in quotation, if one proposed the deal and agreed to it before the elders, then it was all right. It was sold. Kind of like signing on the dotted line of the contract. And so Boaz asked this near kinsman to do that. "Being as you are not going to accept the responsibility as a near kinsman, then will you give me the right to do that?" Now I want to call something else to your attention. This idea of being a near kinsman was not just something that was a custom. Turn back, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapter 25. In Deuteronomy chapter 25, reading beginning at verse 5, Moses had written, "If brethren dwell together, and one of them die and have no son, the wife of the dead shall not be married without unto a stranger. The husband's brother shall go in unto her and take her to him to wife, and perform the duty of a husband's brother unto her. And it shall be that the firstborn that she beareth shall succeed in the name of his brother that is dead, that his name be not blotted out of Israel." You read that on down through verse 9. Now that sounds familiar, doesn't it? In Matthew chapter 22, you remember when the Sadducees are trying to ask Jesus a question that he can't answer. They said, "A man had a wife, and the man died, and he didn't have any children. And his brother took his wife, and he died, and didn't have any children. And there were 7 brothers, and they all had her, and died, and no children. Now, in the resurrection, whose wife shall she be?" You see where that came from? You see the practice observed here in the book of Ruth. A near kinsman had that responsibility. Now Boaz is going to accept that responsibility because the nearest kinsman is not willing to do that. She receives redemption then from Boaz. Now, what does it take to make that happen? Let's look, if you will, beginning in verse 7. Chapter 4. Now this was the custom in the former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning exchanging to confirm all things. Now Caitlin, listen to this. A man drew off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor. And this was the manner of attestation in Israel. So the near kinsman said unto Boaz, buy it for thyself. And he drew off his shoe. And Boaz said unto the elders and unto all the people, ye are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Imelech's and all that was Chilon's and Milon's in the land of Naomi, or of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth, the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead be not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. Ye are witnesses this day. In verse 11, they said, we are witnesses. Now, what's taking place? Boaz said, I'm going to do this. I'm going to accept this responsibility because the nearest kinsman is not willing to do that. And in order to seal the deal, as it were, the nearest kinsman took off his shoe and gave it to Boaz. And how would you like to sign on the dotted line by taking off your shoe and giving it to somebody to seal the contract? You see, that was an indication that Boaz had the right to put his foot on the land that was Naomi's. It's yours. Now you'll also notice in the text that Boaz took Ruth to be his wife. Now, here's where it gets exciting, at least as far as I'm concerned. Ruth and Boaz had a child, and his name was Obed. Now, an interesting note just here, it tells us the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying there's a son born to Naomi, and they called his name Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Get that now. Now, these are the generations of Perez. Perez begat Hezron, and Hezron begat Ram, and Ram begat Amminadab, and Amminadab begat Nahshon, and Nahshon begat Salmon, and Salmon begat Boaz, and Boaz begat Obed, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David. Now, why is that so exciting? Well, if you'll turn over into the New Testament, you'll begin to read these genealogies. And if you'll read in Matthew's account, chapter 1, in verse 5, Matthew chapter 1, verse 5, it tells us, and Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab, and Boaz begat Obed of Ruth, and Obed begat Jesse, and Jesse begat David the king. Now, why is that so important? Look at verse 1. And the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. Genealogies sometimes can be a bit boring to study, sometimes we think. But this particular genealogy is very important, because it tells us of the place of Ruth in the lineage of Jesus. And that's important. Ruth, a Moabitess, not an Israelite, but she had a place in the lineage of Jesus. The name Obed occurs only in Ruth, chapter 4, verse 17, and in these genealogical accounts that you see on the board. Ruth was an important character, wasn't she? And so when you study about Ruth, don't think that she was just an insignificant Old Testament character. She was a very important character in the history of God's people because she was faithful to God. She expressed loyalty and commitment to Naomi. She was willing to work hard And she maintained a good reputation, one that someone like Boaz would want to marry. And she became in the lineage of the Savior. You've listened carefully, patiently. I hope that it's been interesting to you and some lessons of value to you. But perhaps I'm talking to someone who is not a Christian. You need to obey the gospel. You need to become faithful to the Lord, believing that Jesus is the Christ, turning from your sin in repentance, confessing your faith, being baptized into Christ, raised to walk a new life, pure and clean, separated from sin. Maybe you've done that and you've not lived as you know you should. Remember that Ruth was faithful to the Lord. She left everything in order to serve the Lord. And my friend, you need to do that. You need to correct those things and be faithful. If we can help you by praying with you and for you, that's our desire. Express your desires. We stand and sing this song.